Thanks to everybody for coming along to this talk. It's part of an ongoing project that will conclude in a book around Handsworth Songs. For a long time now, I've thought that Handsworth Songs was the subject of a lot of generic surveys, surveys on national cinema, surveys on documentaries, surveys on the essay film, surveys on British cinema, surveys on 80s cinema. But I felt that these surveys work to foreclose a close study of this work. In fact, I think Black cinema as such lacks close readings, sustained, substantive, exorbitant, excessive readings. So when Henry invited me to participate in this program, I took the opportunity to present the beginning of this work on Handsworth Songs. As Henry said, next week, I'm gonna go on to analyze Handsworth Songs as what John Okonfor characterizes as a project in Black industrial aesthetics. This week, I'm looking at Handsworth Songs as what Okwi Enwuzor called dub cinema. The argument is that they are really the vehicles for each other. Dub cinema is the vehicle for Black industrialism. Black industrialism is the means by which dub cinema comes into existence. A good way to put, to kind of clarify what I mean by these is for us to show a couple of clips. So first we're going to see an amazing sequence that has just emerged on YouTube, which is the British television news, ITN News, I think at 5:45 or 6 p.m. on the 10th of September, 1985. So the second evening of the civil disturbances in Handsworth. So we're going to begin by playing the first 3 minutes of that. And then we'll come out of that and go into the first 9 minutes of Handsworth Songs. And then when we come out of that, then we'll begin my talk. Listen to those echoing voices, those vocalic echoes, those spiraling echoes. All parts of the community, all parts of the community, all parts of the community, all parts of the community. This day remains, this day remains, this day remains, this day remains, this day remains. What you hear at the beginning of Handsworth Songs are those denominated male voices of white British police interviewed on British national television for the evening news of the 9th and 10th of September, 1985. Ex-nominated male voices whose authority authorizes them to operate as the primary definers, whose words seek to win the war of naming the problem of civil disturbance, by predefining the disturbance of civility as the problem of the race and the problem of the riot, defined as, quote, the violent disturbance of the peace by an assembly or body of persons, an outbreak of lawlessness or disorder among the populace. On 9th and 10th September 1985 in Handsworth, on the 28th of September in Brixton, on the 6th of October 1985 in Tottenham, television amplifies the primary definitions of the police. What we hear at the beginning of Handsworth Songs is the cut into this primary definition. What we hear is the politics of echo, what Edward George calls the law of subtraction of dub. what Ian Penman calls the oscillation and the elision of Dab, Dab's voice of authority. In 2007, Okwuenwuzor argues that Handsworth songs can be understood as, quote, a historically inflected Dab cinema, whose spatial, temporal, and psychic dynamics relays the scattered trajectories of immigrant communities in order to elaborate upon these dynamics. In order for us to think the spatial, the temporal, and the psychic dynamics in their simultaneity and in their articulation, to think these scattered trajectories in their widest possible dispersion, to think the historical inflection of Dab cinema, to think the turning point at which Dab cinema comes to be formulated, it's necessary to return to and expand upon Enwuzor's formulation, to treat the dynamics that relayed these scattered trajectories as that which constitutes what was and what could be a Dab cinema that refers to 1986, that was formulated in 2007, and which operates as a proposition for thinking Dab cinema for the year 2020 and beyond. To hold these formulations of Dab cinema in 1986, in 2007, when Enwuzor wrote it, and in 2020, it might be worth proposing that Dab, which we can understand as a methodology, as a black morphology, in the words of Keith Hudson, as a sonic process, as a historical ontology, as a political ontology, as an acoustomology, in the words of Stephen Feld, it might be worth understanding Dab as a project of technogenesis for developing what Black Audio Film Collective theorized, enacted, inaugurated, and instituted in their name and in their theory and in their practice as the idea of Black audio. What if we think of the idea of Black audio as a cine-sonic ecology for the theorization of Black cinema, of what Black film could be, of what it might be, perspectively, subjunctively, hypothetically, propositionally, as that which has been hitherto unthought in Britain? What if we approach the idea of Black audio as a cine-sonic ecology for thinking the idea of Black film in relation to the thought of Black collectivity? A cine-sonic ecology that emerges from outside of the inside of the informally segregated cine culture of the British left that seeks, that sought, with the best of its intentions, to speak in its name and on its behalf, and in doing so foreclosed the thought of what might constitute Black cinema. The idea of the cine-sonic refers to the Australian critic Philip Brophy's argument that the experience of watching cinema, the experience of watching images, is primarily cine-sonic. When we say, Brophy says, when we say that we watch movies, we underestimate the extent to which the cine-sonic experience is more than a mere optical event. What cinema's critics call the power of visuality, the power of images, what its supporters celebrate as the emotion of images, can be more precisely characterized as the vital drama of cinema's audiovisuality. Much of what we think of as cinema's visual primacy emerges from its sonic dominance. Brophy states that to watch a film without sound is to lose the power, emotion, drama, and vitality of cinema. But shut your eyes. Listen to a film soundtrack. Find yourself moving through the blackness. The blackness in which one can be excited by the orchestration of voices, of atmospheres, effects, and musics. There, in the blackness, through the blackness, the sonic engulfs. It is the unfolding audiovisual carnival that is the cinema. So what preoccupies Brophy is the cinesonic's capacity to, quote, shoot us back into the noise of reality. The noise of reality that he calls the psychological sonorum, which affects our everyday sense of time, space, mass, force, and presence. What counts is cinema's capacity to invent, to manufacture a psychological sonorum, whose noise renews attention to the reality whose parameters it configures. The cinesonic is an ecology in which cinema's capacity to renew attention to the noise of reality is inseparable from its capacity to manufacture an artificial sensorium, a psychological sonorum, a cinematic spectatorship. Brophy's generalized theory of cinesonic ecology requires us to formulate the specificity by which Black Audio Film Collective engineers a singular cinesonic ecology for Hands With Songs. We can draw out the repercussions of the cinesonic ecology of Hands With Songs by a close listening to those first 3 minutes of the ITN 5:45 news, 10th September 1985, and a close listen to those first 7 minutes of Hands With Songs. It becomes clear that Hands With Songs mobilizes a cinesonic ecology in which the aesthetic sociality of post-punk is mobilized within and against the signification spirals of control culture and signification culture that criminalize Black settlement in the post-war British state. On the 9th and 10th of September 1985, Britain witnessed a spate of civil disturbances in the West Midlands, in Birmingham, in the district of Handsworth, followed by further civil disturbances at the end of September 85 and the beginning of October 1985 in the urban centres of South and North London. As John Okumfor wrote for Documentary 11 in 2002, these were violent, tragic events marked by the death of Qasem Ali and Amirali Molledina, two Sikh brothers that ran a post office in Lozelles Road, set on fire on 9 September by unknown rioters. Events marked by the police shooting and subsequent paralysis of Dorothy Cherry Gross at her home in Brixton on 28 September, following the police raid and search for Michael Gross, her son, who was wanted by London's Metropolitan Police in connection with an armed robbery. The death of Cynthia Jarrett on 5th October 1985 due to heart failure after police searched her flat on the Broadwater Farm housing estate in Tottenham, North London, following the arrest of her son, Floyd Jarrett, on suspicion of a suspect car tax disc. And the death of a white policeman, Keith Blakelock, at the hands of unknown assailants on Broadwater Farm on the evening of 5th October 1985. What differentiates Hands with Psalms from other documentaries concerned with investigating the civil disturbances of 1985? Is its reformulation of documentaries imperative of investigation as a mode of comparative audiovisual argumentation that proceeds by a confrontation with the sounds, images, noises, and voices produced by British media? An investigation into civil disturbance that operates by way of an intensive confrontation with the images and sounds produced by British media. As the film critic Judith Williamson explained on her review in the New Statesman magazine on the theatrical release of Hands with Psalms at the Metro Cinema in central London at the start of 1987. Quote, Hands with Songs is a montage of images, sounds, words, that simultaneously explores the surface of the civil disorder in Handsworth, as presented through the media, while raising the ghosts, the histories, personal and political, that hover beneath that surface. Yet the film makes no simple distinction between the superficial and the real. Its images are very much felt as such, from archive footage of colonial labor to the TV picture of Thatcher's alien customs speech. And on one level, it is about the images it is made of, at once impenetrable and resonant. Close quotation marks. If you listen to two points in Williamson's review, the first, images are very much felt as such. The second, on one level, it is about the images it is made of. What Williamson grasped in the felt structure, the structure of feeling evoked by those images, in her focus on the fact that Hands with Songs is about the images it is made of, Williamson grasped that Hands with Songs can be understood as an intensive and mediated encounter that the film theorist Nicole Brenez calls visual study. Visual study is a matter of a frontal encounter, a face-to-face encounter between an existing image and a figurative project dedicated to observing it. In other words, it is a study of the image by means of the image itself. This recursive focus on the image by means of the image opens onto what Brenez calls the vital question that is enacted by visual study, the question of the capacity of an image. What is an image capable of? What are its forces? What are its powers? What are the powers of the image understood by way of the powers of song, understood by way of songs? The song in the Hands with Songs can be heard as a matter of voices, of tones, of registers, from the mighty Douglas Calypso, Bound to Split Me in Two, to Jar Shaka playing Vivian Jones's Flashitan Guam, to an Amharic funeral song, to a Sikh funeral song, to a working song by the white working classes on Labor Day, to a calypso sung in Philip Donnellan's film, The Colony, to Lord Kitchener's calypso, London is the Place for Me, to an industrial ballad in the Black Country of the afterlife of white working men, to Mark Stewart and the Mafia's 1982 version of Elgar's 1922 Jerusalem, to a working men's hymn of Jerusalem, to Trevor Matheson's electronic rumba, to Trevor Matheson's transposition of Throbbing Gristle's Cozy Fanny Tootie's Process Cornet from the live recording of Throbbing Gristle's Heathen Earth into the majestic immiseration of Processed Whale Song, to Trevor Matheson's refinement of the industrial electronic drones produced by Cabaret Voltaire for their concert for the final Academy in honor of Burroughs at Brixton in 1982, to Trevor Matheson's refinement of Test Department's Musique Concrète, to incorporate what Brophy calls the fabric of song, is to proceed from cinema by way of knowledge of the power of song, to allow the song a primacy of place in cinema, is to think of Hansworth songs not so much as a cinematic album or a filmic mixtape or a mix, as a series of radiophonic narratives in which the story and the stories and the ghost of stories are not so much told or narrated, but broadcast, transmitted, and mixed. What Hansworth Song studies is the precise fixation of British television, of British newspapers, of British radio, with the production of what Okomfor calls the anxiety-driven loop of morbid responses to the presence of Blacks in Britain. What preoccupies the Black Audio Film Collective is the media as a force of amplification, media as a spiral of amplification and signification, media as an amplitude of demonization. By demonization is meant racialization. By racialization is understood a process of social ascription through social amplification by the primary agents of control and the primary agents of signification. The convergence of the control culture of the law and the police with the signification culture of television, radio, and the newspapers. Black Audio Film Collective study the incapacity of the British media to go beyond its concern with demonizing or rationalizing the rioters of Handsworth and Brixton and Tottenham. And this understanding of images and sounds, of voices and noises as forces generated by anxieties that they engender. This understanding of media as a widening and tightening of spirals that amplify anxiety, as a widening and a tightening that engenders anxiety as an effect and as a cause. This understanding of media as a process driven by the imperative to demonize the figure of the rioter, to rationalize the motives of the rioter. This understanding of media as the engendering of anxiety-driven loops that amplify as they signify and signify by way of amplification. This understanding draws upon the theoretical understanding of the production of moral panic as a consent to coercion, as a consent to authoritarianism, engendered by British media, an understanding developed and elaborated in the text Policing the Crisis, Mugging the State and Law and Order, 1978, collectively written by Stuart Hall, Chas Kreicher, Tony Jefferson, Sean Clark, and Brian Roberts, all of whom were graduate students at the Center for Cultural Studies at Birmingham between 1973 to 1977. What policing the crisis studies on one level is the analysis of the moral panic engineered by control culture and signification culture around the incidents of mugging by black youth in Handsworth. What it studies are the self-conforming loops by which television news proceeds through quotations from the police that it stages on television, citations that television then proceeds to cite, quotations that newspapers then quote. The British media adopts Stuart Hall's primary definitions, which delimit and contain, engender and enable. The media speaks in and as the voice of law and order by addressing the riot as the enemy to be condemned. Stuart Hall et al. State, the signification spiral is a way of signifying events which also intrinsically escalates their threat. The notion of a signification spiral is similar to that of an amplification spiral, as developed by certain sociologists of deviance. An amplification spiral suggests that reaction has the effect, under certain conditions, not of lessening, but of increasing deviance. The signification spiral is a self-amplifying sequence within the area of signification. The activity or event with which the signification deals is escalated, made to seem more threatening within the course of signification itself. Media demonization, that is, media racialization, operates as a self-amplifying sequence that repeats, recycles, and reaffirms its own definition. A sequence that widens and tightens, expands and contracts the spirals of its amplification. A sequence that closes the cycles and the circles of its self-amplifying demonization. An ideological closure that protects its demonization from critique while expanding and contracting the dimensions of its closure. It is the notion of the signification spiral as a self-amplifying sequence within the area of signification that Handsworth Songs redirects and transduces. To do so requires thinking of media as a feedback system. It requires understanding the Centre for Cultural Studies as the production of a political counter discourse that produces diagrams for comprehending and reconfiguring the production of spirals of demonization as racialization. It requires understanding the Black Audio Film Collective's project as a process of feedback, a process of counter-demonization, a demonization that undertakes to reverse the direction of race as the course of riot. As Stuart Hall writes, it is through the operation of racism that Blacks are beginning to comprehend how the system works. It is through a specific kind of Black consciousness that they are beginning to appropriate or come to consciousness of their class position, organize against it, and fight it out. If race is the conductor of Black labor to the system, it is also the reversible circuit along which forms of class struggle and modes of resistance are beginning to move. Dub cinema moves within this reversible circuit, this circuit along which forms of class struggle are beginning to move. It undertakes to reverse the direction of race as the course of riot. To enter into and reverse the spirals of demonization, to produce images and sounds and voices and noises that construct race as a process by which riot engenders racialization. In riot strike riot, the new era of uprisings, Joshua Clover argues that to enter into riot is to be in the category of persons whose location in the social structure compels them to some forms of collective action rather than others. Thus, we might finally argue that the term race riot has an inverted sense, not that of race as cause of riot, but of riot as part of the ongoing process of racialization. It is not that race makes riots, but that riots make race. The reversible circuit. Listen to what those first denominated men are saying. The first man says that you can't really put it, meaning the riot, down to a color fight between black youth and Asian youth. You understand, he says, the man them a fight for a cause. He says, well, you can't really say it's a color fight, you know. You can't put it down, right? But it's like a man say, most of the shops of them are get burned. Let's face it, it's Indian owned, most of them, you understand. And it's just unfortunately a them shop they burn and Indian owned them. So it's mostly Indian place burned down if you come to that. But one or two different kind of people, white man get licking of the process, black man get licking of the process. You know, enough man feel it all over, you see? So you can't really put it down to color fight, you understand? The man them a fight for a cause. And the second man states that black youth just feel for say that they've had enough. He says, and it was not no black people were burning neither. It was just chuck. It was mixed, man, see? You want to know where it start from, really? He's a stupid police boy. Yeah, where see a man park on a double yellow line and drive him out and push all him head in a passing bus wheel. But the driver could just skank on him brakes. See? If no crash in the brains now, the people them never like it. So it's just fight. So them, meaning the police, hold another brother and sit down upon him, and the people never like it. So it's just fight. So them, meaning the police, arrest him. And the people just say, release them. And them are gone with foolishness. So blood start, Jehovah. So as the man say, referring to the first man, before now, others hearing the news, meaning journalists, rush from outside and all about. And rushing time to look for some pickings, yeah? Jehovah. And you have some say, well, it's black against Indian, as the brother show you before, rubbish that talk, see? It's just police and them stupidity that them keeping up on black people and black people do just feel for say they have had enough, see? So everybody just joined together for cramp and paralyze them stupid situation. Hands with Songs can be understood as a dub cinema. A cinema in dark, a cinema that renders visible and audible the process by which riots make race. A cinema in dub that concentrates the sounds and the images at a distance from the self-contained drama of the riot. What the riots represent is less a self-contained drama of rage with a single origin and a single trajectory, then a multiplicity of issues, of ambivalences, to do with race, to do with longing, to do with belonging, not all of which can be shored up or propped up by recourse to a rhetoric of civil disorder. To question the containment of the riots, the riots as a contained drama, as a drama of self-containment, the containment of riots as a drama, is to question the fixation on the riots as a drama that can be contained by means of their single origin and by means of their trajectory. The forms of the questions posed by Home Secretary Douglas Hurd in the crowd in his visit on 10th September, he asks the crowd, what's the cause, to which young man struggles to to which one young man struggles to answer, well, it's unemployment, it's everything. To which Hurd replies, well, unemployment affects everyone. You can hear the young man struggle to enunciate what everything entails. A television reporter, occluded by a crouching cameraman, asks Mr. Nishal, the local councillor, a question. Something seems to have gone terribly wrong, doesn't it? To which Mr. Nishal struggles to answer. He says, stammering, what seems to be the problem, nobody has the faintest idea. But the problem is in the question. It is the form of the question that demands the response of the motive, the intention, the cause, the origin. The question confronts the politician with the obligation to explain the reason for the riots. And faced with this obligation to explain, he struggles to articulate the idea that there is no single origin or trajectory. The question forecloses the understanding that the riots cannot be contained to themselves, that the riot cannot be contained by itself, that the riot cannot be explained as a drama or contained by the drama of race. To question the containment of the riots to the coherence of drama is to undermine the self-contained drama of the riots by undoing its containment so that the riots are unbound from drama and are assembled as a multiplicity of issues, of ambivalences to do with what Okonfa calls race, longing, and belonging. To unbind these issues and unrestrained ambivalence is to assert the uncontrolled multiplicity of those issues, the unrestrained multiplicity of what gets contained as race, the uncontrolled ambivalences that are subsequently narrated as race, the infinite ambivalences of belonging that cannot be supported by recourse to a rhetoric of civil disorder, the absolute ambivalence of longing that cannot rely upon a rhetoric of disorder to support them, to prevent them from falling, from collapsing into an abyss unbound by the guarantees of race. In coalition building, Black Audio Film Collective and transnational post-colonialism, Enrazor introduces the idea of dub cinema as follows. Though ostensibly addressing the issues of policing, Hanswa Songs reflects more profoundly the agency of the oppressed. It narrates their stories not purely from the point of view of the event from which it derives its name, but equally through an archaeology of the visual archive of minoritarian dwelling in Britain. But what if Hanswa Songs addresses the issues of policing by way of narrating the agency of the oppressed? A narration of stories, not purely from the point of view, but equally through an archaeology of the visual archive of minoritarian dwelling. But what is missing from Enwazor's account is the taking into account of the audiovisual archaeology that moves by way of the cinesonic archive of the minoritarian dwelling of the songs that dwell by way of its voices, its tones, its registers, in order to approach cinema as a radiophonic narrative in which story is not so much told as transmitted and mixed. The move from the point of view of the event to the archaeology of the archive to the broadcast of the radiophonic that operates by way of the scattering of the minoritarian means hearing what David Marriott in Bastard Allegories, Black British Independent Cinema, calls the special status of the archive that is composed not of dominant codes of memory or reminiscence, but of supplementary meaning, the style, the scene, the language by which blackness as a signifier is marked by various ruptures or shifts in its meaning and in its history, where what is preserved is marked by its very dispersion rather than by its essence, and what is exhumed can never be foreclosed by its gathering into a mythical embodiment. What it reveals is not so much the confinement of policing to the self-contained drama of the riots, but the extent to which race polices Black people, the extent to which documentary polices Black people, the extent to which television polices Black people, the extent to which newspapers police Black peoples, radio polices Black peoples, the evening news polices Black peoples, the newsreel polices Black peoples in and by way of the policing operations of race. As Barna Hess writes in White Sovereignty, Black Life Politics, the N-word they couldn't kill. The question of race is always a question of its repetition as hierarchy, segregation, and normativity. To ignore this configuration of repetition is to discount how race has always had a policing function. To think the multiplicity of the riot is to extend multiplicity towards a rethinking of Black British presence. To think the multiplicity of Black British presence is to rethink Black British presence as that which is not contained in itself. It is to refute the idea of a homogeneous Black community with a single sense of presence, characterized by what Okonfor calls a uniformity of ambition and expression. To refute the idea of the homogeneous Black new community is to refute the homogeneity that acts in the name of the unity of Blackness. It is to refute the idea of a community that unifies Blackness and a Blackness that unifies community, a homogeneity guaranteed or secured or ensured by the assertion of and fixation on a single sense of presence. As Okonfor put it in 1988, the central ideal which overrides all kinds of aesthetic considerations in Handsworth Songs is in some way to put across a multi-layered text, which if it doesn't specify, at least hints at the possibility that there is no single origin to the disturbances. And that if there is one, it is so bound up with a multiplicity of issues that it would have been incorrect to isolate one and say this is the unitary cause. So the aesthetic quest was in some ways to access an impressionistic collage of a series of moments, a series of becomings, a series of moments of solitude, which as they threaten to be moments of solitude are recuperated into race and become racial questions. This sense of menace by race, of race as a policing mechanism of capture and control, is the question that mobilizes us to return finally to the question, how can we think the cinematic implications of dub? How can we understand the extra cinematic implications of dub as a sonic process for Black cinema? How can we theorize the ecological implications of dub as sonic process for the becoming of Black cinema? As early as 1988, in her interview with Black Audio Film Collective, the artist and theorist Coco Fusco identified the performative capacity of the cinesonic image. Coco Fusco observed that some British critics, quote, had attempted to specify specific avant-garde influences in Black Audio Film Collective's work, citing Eisenstein and Godard as predecessors. Such assertions, she noted, have undoubtedly helped to legitimate the filmmakers in the eyes of some. But these assertions have nonetheless overlooked the collective's direct concern with current media trends and with rethinking Black aesthetics that compels us to look elsewhere. What if this elsewhere was the work of Dub in its post-punk formation, or the sonic process of Dub in its industrial phase? What if hearing the process of looking elsewhere alters the location of elsewhere? What if attending to the listening of elsewhere opens the question of the temporality as much as the spatiality of current media aesthetics, which in turn concern the temporality as much as the spatiality of Black aesthetics? The Black Audio Film Collective were indeed, quote, well-schooled in Eurocentric avant-garde aesthetics. But this observation failed to account for the extent to which their knowledge of and familiarity with the European Eurocentric avant-garde was inseparable from their familiarity with and knowledge of popular media forms. What Coco Fusco perceived then was that the work of Black Audio Film Collective was inseparable from the experiences of, quote, a cultural environment in which musical performance can function as a laboratory for experimenting with ready-made, technologically reproduced materials. And this laboratory is nothing but the British milieu of cinesonic performativity within which the collective participated. What if the idea of Black audio emerges from and participates in and contributes to the cinesonic ecology of cinesonic performativity, an ecology in which the relations between sound and voice, image and noise and text are not structured in subordination to each other, but emerge in performance to each other? What Coco Fusco described, without ever naming it, was the performative laboratory of British post-punk music subculture, in which the mutational effects of dub are inseparable from that of industrial culture, in which post-punk operates as the matrix in which what we know as industrial and what we know as dub converge in the work of Black Audio Film Collective, in which industrial music is the vehicle for the defamiliarization of dub, and dub is the medium for the denaturalization of industrialism. In Stepping Out of Babylon, Race, Class and Autonomy, Paul Gilroy argued that dub is not a style of music as such. It is a process of enrichment in which music is deconstructed and the meaning of its lyrics transformed and expanded. Focusing on both the processed and natural sounds of each instrument in turn, and in a variety of combinations with sound effects mixed in, the dub engineer is able to expose the musical anatomy of the piece, showing how each layer of instrumentation complements the others to form a complex whole. It is tempting to view the process which lays bare the structure beneath the unified exterior of the whole unmodified version as an expressive homology for the raster view of the world. Close quotation marks. For Gilroy, dub is a process of enrichment in which music is deconstructed, It is an exposure of the musical anatomy of a composition, a performative process that lays bare the structure beneath the unified exterior. For Ian Penman, however, to take dub seriously as deconstruction entails a formulation in which, to quote Derrida, nothing in either the elements or the system is anywhere ever simply present or absent, which in turn requires a refutation of what Penman calls the banal notion propagated by conventional criticism, in which dub merely exposes the bare bones of song. By contrast, Penman opens the question of what then is produced in dub, to which he answers, neither a song nor an instrumental. It is a version, strictly, one version of the truth. Molecular reconfiguration of time plus manipulation of space that transcends criticism's presiding tenets of realism. Beyond skepticism, beyond skeptical, beyond secular, dub's producers use the circuits of the mixing desk to impart a feeling of obedience, transport, firmness, dread, of imminent judgment, downfall, lightning, thunder, foundations trembling. The mixing desk is used like both a camera and an editing desk. Dub is not a soundtrack in the sense of a post-synchronized cloak of suggestion. It is not a heavy-handed prompt. Dub, rather, is the soundtrack of the process of hearing, rendered imminent. It is not a soundtrack to lives lived, made background. It is life rendered as soundtrack. If the meaning in the malaise of the riot is to be found in events far outside the frame of contemporary reportage, then what Handsworth's songs proposed was not only that reportage itself was a means of policing crisis, not only that television itself was a means of containing crisis within the contained drama of the riots, but that the terminology of riot, the word, the discourse, the vocabulary, the meaning, the history, the politics, stood in the way of understanding the inventory of traces that constituted the encumbered political ontology of the becoming of Black British presence. The argument of Handsworth Songs in 1986 entailed the cinematic articulation of a theoretical project formulated by the authors of Policing the Crisis in 1978. They wrote, the pattern of crime, but also the nature of the social reaction, has a prehistory, conditions of existence, strikingly absent from all the publicity concentrated on the single incident. Both have a location in institutional processes and structures, apparently far away from the scene of the crime. It is this striking absence that requires the construction of a method signaled by the principle of representation. There are no stories in the riots, only the ghosts of other stories. As Judith Williamson noted in 87, this line, this principle, is at the heart not only of the meaning of Handsworth Songs, but of its structure, or rather, its meaning is inseparable from its structure. To conclude then, the methodology of Handsworth Songs can be formulated through the idea of collaborative expectancies in time, a notion formulated by Stephen Feld and Charles Keel in order to understand the production of meaning and affect between film and viewer, And these expectancies in time, these collective and collaborative expectancies in time, constitute the rhythms that are both audible and inaudible, that travel through a film and underlie its representations of time. These expectancies in time are primarily constituted and felt rhythmically. And for this reason, disparities between the anticipated fall of a beat and the actual fall always make the missed beat palpable in some way. As Jody Brooks writes in Invisibility's Beat, the thwarting of collaborative expectancies in time is most obvious when there's a disparity between the anticipated duration of a movement, a shot, or a sound, and its actual duration. In such instances, the anticipated can haunt the actual through the missed beats which are left suspended. It is this co-presence in which actual duration is haunted by anticipated duration that enables a temporal breach in film. When actual duration is haunted by the missed beats of anticipated duration, their co-presence produces a fissure in time. So to finally conclude, it's this fissure in time that can be linked finally to Black Audio Film Collective's rendering of Policing the Crisis, understanding of what Jody Brooks calls the refutation of temporal unity and temporal singularity. Stuart Hall concludes, crime has been cut adrift from its social roots. Something is standing in the way of these conditions of existence, being treated as part of the phenomenon. And part of what is in the way, producing crime, so to speak, as a simple and transparent fact, is the label of mugging itself. It cannot be allowed to stand in all of its common sense immediacy. It has to be dismantled, dismantled in terms of its wider relation to these contradictory social forces. And so for mugging, read riot. And for magging and riot, read crisis. And for crisis, read race. And for race, read whiteness. The effect, the effort to study the policing of crisis leads towards the reconstruction of the making of diasporicity as blackness in 20th century Britain. What it entails is the poeticization of moments that seem to have little affective relation to the expressions of discontent that characterize the riots of 1985. Moments that do not have recourse to the rhetoric of the civil or the rhetoric of disorder. Moments that exceed capture by the racializing spirals of amplification. Moments that elude capture by the amplification of demonization. Moments whose relations appear to bypass causality altogether. Moments whose affective distanciation decouples itself from the anchorage within the annals of post-war news reportage. Moments in which Hansworth Songs transforms cinema into an archive of Black unbelonging. Okay, thank you.